Because he lives in Mayapur for the last like 30, 35 years, I was asking him about the system, a traditional system of initiation in India, and then the system of initiation in Gaudiya Math. And something that I kind of understood and I wanted clarity on. So the first question I was asking is the correlation between first initiation, what we call first initiation, and second initiation. And is second initiation absolutely necessary? Because in some scriptures, well, I have to go back a little bit. Traditionally, there was no first initiation and no second initiation. There was only one initiation. And so when you got the holy name, that wasn't initiation. But when you got your diksha mantras, which were the mantras that you chant silently, which we call Gayatri, but Gayatri is only one of them. They're Vaishnava diksha mantras. When you got those mantras, at that time, it's when you got initiated, not when you got Harinam. That was the tradition. There was one initiation. And in that one initiation, you would get a new name, you would get Tulsi beads, three strands, because when you get initiated, you take three strands of Tulsi, you change your name. These are the five things that are part of Vaishnava initiation. You, if you're a Ramanuja, you brand yourself with a hot iron, but instead of branding, we do the neck beads. And the neck beads symbolize giving up material life, you're finished with material life, and the tilak symbolizes you're now positively going up to Krishna. The Tulsi beads are giving up the negative. You change your name to be identified as a servant of Krishna. And then there's two more. One is called yajna, which means you... So, and the other one. What's the other one? I forgot the other. What's the fifth one? Tilak beads, on the end, you get the mantra. But the mantra doesn't mean the maha mantra, it means the, these are called diksha mantras. Panchara Triki diksha mantras. And then when you have these mantras, you can do deity worship. Now, something really interesting, that in Mayapur, there's a boys' school, and the boys get what's called Upanayanam when they're 12 years old, around that age, and then they get Gayatri mantra. And then they can do deity worship. They don't have first initiation. They don't have second initiation. They have Upanayanam, Brahminical initiation. With Brahminical initiation, they can do Vedic deity worship, not Panchratriki worship, which means they can worship certain deities and not others. And every Brahmin boy, when he's 12 years old, he gets Upanayanam, which allows him to study the Vedas and do deity worship. So at this school, you have this whole group of boys, many who don't have first initiation or second initiation worshipping deities, but they have, and they all wear Brahmin threads. So that's a system called Upanayanam. So that the boy, the Brahmin boys, so it's not a Vaishnava initiation, they just get the Gayatri mantra. So, there are five aspects of initiation. Now, these five have now been divided into two, and the first three you get at first initiation, and the second two you get at second initiation. The first, you get a new name. What was your name before?
Pratik.
So Prema Ras used to be Pratik.
Anuradha
is now, she already had a nice name. Anuradha is now Ananda Vrindavan.
Rajendra
is now Madhava. So, of course, they already had names but anyway, the spiritual master gives you a new name. You put on three strands of Tulsi, you wear the tilak, and then you take vows. And then the other two, the diksha mantras and the learning the process of deity worship, come with second initiation, what we call second initiation, which at one point was one initiation. So I've been studying a little bit about initiation, and in some scriptures it talks about second initiation as something which is necessary to realize your relationship with Krishna. Through second initiation, you realize your sarup. And so I was asking about that, questioning. And the first question I had was, do we require second initiation? Is it necessary? Because some shastras say yes, and Prabhupada said it's not necessary. Harinam is everything. And Harinam can reveal your relationship. There's the Diksha mantras can reveal it. The Guru can reveal it. It can come in any of those ways. And and then he said something interesting, which I'd never heard before. He said, when I was asking, is second initiation required? He said, if you're not in Satvagun, if you're not Brahmatical, the Diksha mantras you get at second initiation won't do anything for you. You have to be in Satvagun for them to work, otherwise they won't work. Interesting. You can't, if you're not living a Brahmatical life and you chant Brahmatical mantras and you chant the other Diksha mantras, they don't work. So then he explained. He said, why? This is Bhaktivedya Purnaswami, if you don't know. He has the school, so I was asking him these questions. And he said, why did we divide it in two? And when did that start? He said, it started with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Because it was the first time that Krishna consciousness was brought out to people in mass who were not already Gaudiya Vaishnavas. Because generally, you would do one initiation. You didn't, because they were already, living a Brahmanical lifestyle. So they just do the whole, that initiation was just one initiation. They're already very elevated. They're raised as devotees and so forth. He said, when Bhaktisiddhanta went out to massively give Krishna consciousness, then you're giving it to people who may not have any background in Krishna consciousness. So then they gave the first initiation as a means of elevating people. And if they would become elevated to Satvagun, then they would give them second initiation. But if they weren't, they would just leave it at first initiation. So it was like it was a division to get them ready. And a lot of times when you ask Prabhupada about, not when you ask, but you read what Prabhupada said about second initiation, he said, first we give to more liberally to prepare, and then you give second. So then we have this example that's sometimes given, many of you have heard, that the Maha Mantras is a larger circle inside a smaller circle, and the smaller circle is the Gayatri Mantra, and the Maha Mantra is a larger circle, because the Maha Mantra in a larger circle, the larger circle goes higher, but it also goes lower. You've heard that example? It goes higher, but it goes lower. So the Maha Mantra, you don't have to be initiated to chant it. But Gayatri, and the Diksha Mantra, Vaishnava, you have to be initiated. So therefore it doesn't go as low. It only picks up people who are qualified. But it doesn't take you as high as the Maha Mantra. So it's an inner circle. It doesn't go as low or as high. The Maha Mantra picks up people lower and takes them higher. So traditionally, you couldn't chant a mantra if you weren't initiated. You get initiated, like Upanayanam, you get mantras, and you could study the scripture. So therefore, in the scripture it says, the holy name doesn't depend on anything. You can chant it. It doesn't depend on initiation. You can chant, so anybody can chant it. But then, who's chanting? Sounds like Janavi. It's not her, no? Then Prabhupada says, if you worship the deity, then it helps your chanting. It's brahminical. It elevates your chanting. Is it absolutely necessary? No, but it's helpful. Because in one sense you could say, if you're already perfected being, then you don't even need initiation. You just chant the holy name, Shuddhanam. But still, as a practice, everyone accepted a guru to set the example. But initiation helps. Initiation is recommended. And second initiation helps because when you get second initiation, you can engage in deity worship, and that helps purify you more. You live a brahminical life. What's a brahminical life? You get up early. You're clean. You worship deities. You study scripture. You're not out at the movies, restaurants, this and that. That's a brahminical life. So when you live that life, then your spiritual master will see that. He may offer you second initiation. But if you're not qualified, as Maharaj said, the mantras won't work because you have to be Satvagun for them to work. So, yes?
Do you Guruji, what about, because we are also worshipping deities in the house, and we have not got
He was asking, well, what if you're worshipping deities at home and you don't have second initiation? Try to get it. It would be better. You should have upanayanam, in theory. But we don't do this in ISKCON. You should have brahminical upanayanam. But Mara said, you know, after you're like 16, you can't get it. But in other lines, they'll give an adult upanayanam. No first initiation, no second, just give him upanayanam, now he can worship the deity. But we don't do that in ISKCON. So, if you like worshipping deities, then you should strive to get second initiation. You can also worship deities in the temple. And I'm not an expert in deity worship. You know, for me, it's always been a little ambivalent about home deity worship. What's the standard of that? You know, Gaurini Thai will accept worship. Other forms of worship. If you're born a Brahmin family, you got upanayanam when you were 12, and then you worship your shalagram. You can worship shalagram shila with upanayanam, but certain deities you can't worship, and you can't do the pancharatriki worship because you're not initiated with the pancharatriki mantras, so you can't do worship in the temple. So, now, deity worship also means you see deity worship. You go and you watch deity worship being done. That's equivalent to deity worship, that you're present there. So when we say the spiritual master in the Guru Vashtika, we call these prayers the samsara prayers. They're called the Guru Vashtika prayers. We refer to them as, they're not the samsara, they're the anti-samsara prayers. We say, we're going to chant the samsara prayers. We're not chanting the samsara, we're chanting the anti-samsara prayers. Samsara is birth and death, so we're not chanting the birth and death prayers, we're chanting the anti-birth and death. So, when you go to a temple and you see the deities being worshipped, you are considered to be engaged in deity worship, and deity worship is a very important aspect of Krishna consciousness. It's called the Pancharatrik Marg. You have the Bhagavat Marg, which is the preaching and Krishna consciousness, as we learn through the Bhagavatam, and the Pancharatriki Marg, which is given by Narada, and those are the principles and practices of deity worship and more of the Vaishnava Brahminical life. So, another thing, when you go to the temple and see the deities, the actual understanding or the way to approach it is that you're going and the deities are seeing you. So you're not like you're giving darshan to the deities, but the deities want to see their devotees. So that's another way we participate in deity worship. By being there, the deities see us, we see the worship going on. So it's an important aspect of Brahminical life. And then Prabhupada writes in his books that for Grihasthas, deity worship is very important because they're engaged. Unlike brahmacharis, vanaprasa, and sannyas, they're engaged in activities of the world, and so to purify them, deity worship is there. Morning, evening, they worship the deity. Deity becomes like the center of the house instead of the television. So the question is, should we get second initiation? And the answer is, if you're qualified, yes, you should strive for it. But Prabhupada was more strict about second initiation. And at first he said we can give you very easily. But the initiation is completed with second, and second is for brahminical, for the Brahmins. And Prabhupada said that if we give brahminical initiation and then the devotees don't follow it, it's an hypocrisy because we are criticizing so-called Brahmins by birth, and then if we give brahminical initiation, people don't follow, then we're guilty of what we're condemning others of. So Prabhupada got very strict about second initiations after a while in ISKCON because not everybody was keeping their vows. So, now, first initiation, I've read some very heavy things. For example, devotee asked Prabhupada, said, Prabhupada, what does it mean to love the spiritual master? Prabhupada said, to love the spiritual master means you promise to follow these vows and you follow them. That was his answer. What does it mean to be sincere? You promised You know, a lot of times he, because a lot of people promised and they weren't following. So any question in relation, or many questions in relation to sincerity, to love, and so forth, following, he would answer, what does it mean? It means you promised, so follow. So Prabhupada was very, he was very, very concerned about people taking vows and being serious about them, about following them. He was very, very concerned because sometimes he told us that if you promise, then that's it. You just, now you've promised, so you can't turn back. So he was very heavy. And sometimes he said, if you promise and you don't keep your promise, you're not even a human being. What to speak of a devotee? Very heavy. I mean, like, Prabhupada said, I'm 90% liberal. But if there's anything he was heavy on, it was this. I think, of all the things he was heavy on, this was probably in the top three. Because the things he said were a little bit, you could say, a little bit out of character from his normal, you know, very liberal, compassionate way he dealt with everybody. And it wasn't that he was condemning anybody if they fell down. He was condemning them if they permanently fell and didn't pick themselves up, and by saying, you promised, this is what you promised to do. So it was very, very heavy. So we have a question here. Two questions. I read in some shastra that unless a disciple and a guru make sure about the bona fide ship of each other for some period of time, like a year, they encounter great difficulties in spiritual life. It's not exactly what it is. What it is that if a disciple does not investigate to see if their spiritual master is qualified, and the spiritual master does not investigate to see if the disciple is qualified, and especially if a non-bona fide guru and non-bona fide disciple mix, then it's Bhaktivinoda said they'll both go to hell. So in other words, it's a responsibility of the guru to make sure the disciple is qualified. And if he doesn't, and he just initiates someone who's not really qualified, who doesn't have faith, who can't follow, that will hurt him. And if a devotee accepts someone who's not a Vaishnava, who's not a bona fide Vaishnava, and they accept that person as guru, then that's their mistake. They should have seen, is this person actually a Vaishnava? Now, there's some confusion about this. What is scripture? Because sometimes you accept a guru, and then the guru has difficulty in their spiritual life, and then you think, well, I should reject that guru. That's not what the Shastra says. The Shastra says you reject an initiation if your guru was not a Vaishnava. Let's say it was a family priest or a Mayavadi or something other than a Gaudiya Vaishnava. But if you accepted initiation from a Gaudiya Vaishnava, even if the Gaudiya Vaishnava was not of the highest caliber, and even if that Gaudiya Vaishnava has fallen away, but if they have not turned against Krishna and become non-Vaishnavas, then even if they were bona fide, then initiation is bona fide. Just like if I marry you, I perform the marriage ceremony, and then I leave Krishna consciousness, it doesn't nullify your marriage. I think you tell your husband, okay, now we can get divorced, our marriage is nullified because the priest left. So your initiation is bona fide. Now, what does the Shastra say? If the guru has difficulty, falls away, then if he's still a Vaishnava, you take shelter of another Vaishnava. You take guidance from another Vaishnava. If he was not a Vaishnava at the time of initiation, then you take reinitiation. But the Shastra says, if he was a Vaishnava, then you take shelter. Now that taking of shelter sometimes means that some disciples and gurus will give another initiation. But the GBC initially had recommended that, and later on they realized that what the Shastra says was to take shelter of that guru. It didn't say to take initiation. So they reneged on that and they said, we'll take shelter. So so we were discussing this with Bhakti Vijayapurna Swami, and he made a point which I thought was interesting. He said, what he's noticed is that when somebody comes to Krishna consciousness, often there's many people that guide them. Like we could say six yogurus, you have, you know, a few people. But at some point, you want to take initiation, so you choose somebody. You said, this, the person who inspires you the most, or the person you have the most faith in at that time, or the person who's you're dealing with the most, the person, you know, there's some inspiration there that this is the person I want to accept diksha from. And he said, often what he sees is, at that point, the person relinquishes the other six yogurus, and then the diksha guru becomes the main guru, and those other connections weaken, or they're totally lost. So he was saying that is that's not a proper understanding. But one accepts initiation from diksha guru, but if he has close relationships with other six gurus, you maintain those. You can have more than one guru. And if by chance that diksha guru ever had difficulty, or your relationship somehow became strained, or simply you just were in different parts of the world, whatever, you have other six gurus to take shelter of. So, the problem we've had in the past is that some devotees only had a relationship with one diksha guru, and that diksha guru left, and it was traumatizing. But the ones who were deeply connected with other six gurus, deeply connected with Prabhupada, was not so difficult. So he said that that is an unfortunate situation, that one would kind of, okay, now I'm taking from this guru, and then the other people who are guiding him take a lesser role now. So it shouldn't be. They should still have the same position. Yes?
I read in Shastra that Karya Karana Lipyate. When guru forgets the Karya and Karana, then he should be rejected.
When guru forgets the
Karya and Karana.
Karya and Karana meaning?
Karya means the bhakti, and the practical life, and the Karana means the Krishna.
Yeah.
In Mahabharata,
yeah, if he rejects Krishna. But sometimes what it means you reject your guru, it depends if he was a Vaishnava when he initiated you. If he was, then rejecting means you respectfully distance and take shelter of somebody else. So, little history in ISKCON, and I told this a little bit, but maybe it wasn't so clear, that when the first 11 devotees began initiating, one of the difficulties we ran into, and it became a problem both for the gurus and for everybody else, was that there was a huge distinction made between the diksha guru and all the god brothers, because 11 were chosen, so in 11 parts of the world, 11 zones, somebody was initiating, and that person just got very much elevated above everyone else. And in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, god brothers don't get elevated above everyone else unless it's natural. It's like they are elevated. That's how it happens. It doesn't happen by position. There's respect, obvious respect and protocol given to the guru. But what happened was that it wasn't a team where the god brothers were also recognized as siksha gurus for the same disciples that the guru was initiating. It was a huge distinction. That created a problem, and that isolated the guru, and then all the burden was on him. And the god brothers felt disenfranchised, so to speak. And then the disciples didn't realize that they had so many uncles that they could get guidance from in an equal way as they were getting from their guru. And sometimes a closer way, because they were with the uncles, right? So it's kind of evolved more away from that, not completely, but it's evolved more away from that, where we see a lot of devotees have shelter and guidance from other gurus. What I see now in ISKCON, it's not complete, because usually what happens is devotees tend to find their guidance in other diksha gurus. That's where they look for it. You know, where there's there may be so many siksha gurus, but it will tend to look, well, this one's a diksha guru, so he must be a siksha guru also. As opposed to, well, here's so-and-so. He doesn't have disciples, but, you know, it's a cultural shift that we're still working on. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Prabhu, if we are initiated, if we have taken initiation, and after initiation, if we are more influenced by Siksha Guru, so
yeah.
Is that offense to Siksha Guru?
She's asking if you're more influenced by the Siksha Guru than the Diksha Guru, is it an offense? Not if the if you have the blessings of the Siksha Guru, of the Diksha Guru. If the Diksha Guru didn't like it, that would be because you always want your Diksha Guru is kind of like your what should we say, your foundational point, and so you always want to get approval.
And if he said it's okay, then you can take Siksha from.
Yeah, that's the etiquette to ask. Say, you know, I'm taking Siksha, or I've been taking Siksha and from so and so, and I see him like my Siksha Guru. I just want your blessings, permission to continue. It becomes more tricky when the Siksha Guru is outside of ISKCON, because then it really becomes a challenge for the Diksha Guru, even if he thinks it might be okay for you as an individual, but in terms of the social context, it wouldn't be. We ran into an issue, some devotee told me, in South Africa, where this happened, where the guru did give permission to take guidance from someone outside of ISKCON. And he said, just keep it private, don't tell anybody of your god brothers and god sisters that I told you, because it would create a controversy. But he saw that it would be okay, and he saw that it would be good for her. So what happened was, it became known to the other disciples, and all the other disciples kind of turned away from her. So you see, it's got this other context. Now, if it's within ISKCON, generally it's not a problem, unless your Diksha Guru might have some issues with what that person is teaching. especially if he's anyway contradicting, you know, or. It could be that your guru sees you and understands you and sees a particular mood in you and a particular service, and but if he feels that Siksha Guru doesn't understand that, and like the way he's trying to educate you, and that other guru is in a different mood totally, then he might say, it's okay, but I want you to understand, this is my mood, this is what I think is good for you. His mood is different. If you understand that mood, you hear the philosophy, but this mood is not, you're not ready for it, or it's not how I want to guide you, or it's not, you know. Now, let's say you were very much into book distribution, or very much into Varnashram or something, and so there's a guru that's very much into that. Then it's kind of natural, because that's where you'll get your inspiration. And then, it'll naturally make sense. Guru Maharaj, I'm taking shelter of so-and-so, because I want to be very involved in Varnashram, and he's totally into Varnashram. Okay. Unless your guru thought, you never will understand Varnashram, and you'll never. He might think you're not ready for it. So let me continue. We're having an online class with a studio audience here, and we have questions here. Okay, so what he's asking, I read, okay. Jiva Goswami said, before you accept a guru, you should live with him for a year and study him. Number one, to see if he's bona fide. Check him out at midnight and see if any of the brahmacharinis are going to his house. You know, like, you hear these stories, you know. The lama, you know, the big lama guru, and then, you know, the pretty girl actress from America's, you know, over in his ashram. One disciple wakes up at 1 a.m. one night to go to the bathroom, and he sees the lights on, and she's walking out of the head guy's house. You know, they call him a lama, I think. So generally in ISKCON, that's not so much an issue. Is he bona fide? But still, by your standard, you want to see, is this the kind of person I want to take shelter of, right? And then the other thing Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, is it the right mix? Is this the right, you know, is this, because faith is fundamental to the relationship between guru and disciple, because when there's faith, you can hear. If you don't have faith, you can't hear. So you want to accept guidance from someone you have faith in. Because it's so hard to give up our independence. So how do you give up? You know, your guru says, do this. You don't want to do it. But if you have faith in that person, that he understands me, he has my interest in mind, I want to give myself, I love him, I want to serve him, then when he says that, you can do it. But otherwise, if you don't have that, when he says it, you just go, he doesn't understand me. I'm not going to do that. It's not practical. So you see, does this guru understand me? Do I have faith in his instructions? Does he teach Krishna consciousness in a way that I can surrender to? Does he inspire that in me? Because if he doesn't, it's going to be hard for you. So that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. And if you take it to the furthest length, then it's your responsibility to see if this person is actually Krishna conscious. You will assume if this person is allowed to initiate an ISKCON that he's bona fide. You would assume that, right? But Shastra says, don't assume it. You ultimately have to decide. Not that you go there like Sherlock Holmes to investigate him, you know, you know, put surveillance cameras in his room and say, okay, now I want to see, is he bona fide? Not like that. But it's also to see if he can deliver what you need in your Krishna consciousness. Maybe you have needs that he can't deliver, that somebody else can deliver. Now, sometimes when you take initiation, you're taking initiation into a guru who has a lot of disciples. It's kind of you're taking initiation into a whole family, so you get this whole support group. So sometimes people like that. So it's not just the guru, it's what the guru stands for. He's got a whole program for disciples. And so you get the association of other godbrothers. So some people like that. Some people just accept diksha from the local guru because everyone else is, and that's fine for them. Some people would think that's not good. They should be more independently thoughtful. Other people will say, if they're fine with it, then it's okay. But traditionally in ISKCON, it was kind of like the work was done for you. These are the bona fide gurus. This is the temple you're in. They're close to you. So you don't have to think much. You just do it. You know, that's like the traditional system, right? And so now the GBC wants to have more gurus, so there's more people to go around, so gurus can, you know, take care of people more personally. And then you can see. And you know, there's so many considerations. My guru lives in India, I live in America. Is that going to be good? My guru lives in America, I live in India. Is that going to be good? Is it okay to just hear him on the internet? Is it okay to send him emails? Do I need to be with him? And then, you know, Jiva Goswami says, live with him for a year. How are you going to live? What guru can you live with for a year? Right? Who's going to let? You know, Maharaj, Jiva Goswami says, I should live with you for a year, so I'm ready to go. Well, just let me know your itinerary, I'll book my tickets. Yeah. I mean, maybe he would let you do that. But, and what to speak, if you're a single woman, how are you going to do that? It wouldn't work. So, let's finish this question. So the question is, how do we test a guru and justify to ourselves the validity without being offensive? This is a very good question. And the second part is, how can it be practically applied when being with a guru? May not be very much possible. The guru is always traveling, yeah. So I think we kind of answered that. You kind of accept in ISKCON that if a guru in ISKCON is not bona fide, if he's not Krishna conscious, it's going to be obvious, and the word's going to get out. We haven't seen him chant his rounds. I travel with him. You know, you're his servant. I travel with him. I haven't seen him chant his rounds. It's an issue. You know, it comes out. It's, you know, things like this. So it's not like you really have to do the investigation, you know. We've seen this, you know. It's such a pure and high position that if you don't do it right, you can't fake it that long. You know, you have to be the real thing. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. So I think it's more of a consideration of a relationship. Does this person inspire you? Does this person understand you? Is this somebody you could give your life to? You trust them so much? that you know, because like for us who spread the movement in the early days, how do we do it? It was intense affection and love for Prabhupada. That's how we did it. So we sacrificed a lot. But it was because we wanted to please Prabhupada. So that's the idea. You're almost willing to do anything to please your guru. You know, the idea, my guru, my body belongs to my guru, my heart, my money, my intelligence, everything I give to him. That's, you know, that's like the ideal disciple. I was reading an article by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, and he said that the Western mind has such a problem with submitting to authority, you know, so they asked the question, you know, why do you need this intermediary between you and God? Why can't you just do it yourself? Because who wants to be controlled by someone? You know, you like it when your parents say, don't eat this? When you're sitting down to eat your chocolate cake after dinner and they say, you've had enough sugar this week, don't eat this. You don't like that, do you? You want to do whatever you want. So there has to be this person who engenders within you such dedication that you're willing to be controlled by their instruction. If they say, don't do this, you just, okay, I'm not going to do it, even though you want to do it. That's the idea. Now, once you get initiated 10, 20 years down the road, it could change. And sometimes it does change. And sometimes 20 years down the road, there's somebody else that inspires you. He's your uncle. You take him as a six-year guru, that's fine. As long as you're always respectful to your guru. You think, oh, my new guru teaches this, my Diksha guru teaches that, my Diksha guru, he's not very good. You know, you can't think like that. You know? You always have to be respectful. There's a culture around it. You know? This is my connection. But you're also connected through your Diksha guru. And if your Diksha guru leaves, you don't have to take reinitiation. You take shelter of a Diksha guru and then your service goes through that Diksha guru. It's the same thing. But so many people think, no, I have to take initiation. If you don't have second initiation, okay. If the first initiation was not bona fide, okay. But if it was, if the sacrifice was done, they chanted under your beads, he was a Vaishnava, he did everything. It was, you can't undo that, it was a bona fide initiation. You can't undo it. You can't say no. Okay, I think that answers your question. And now the next question, Timothy, can I develop love of God with only first initiation? Yes, because it's the big circle that goes from the highest, takes you from the lowest position to the highest position. But you can develop love of God if you chant Shuddha Naam. But I would say, okay, for me, you want to hear my history? October 1969, I came to the Hare Krishna temple at the age of 19. By mid-December, so that's
2 months.
2 months, I decided to become a devotee. I finished my school semester, went back the middle of December, or the third week of December, so like that, to tell my parents. I stayed in Los Angeles for a couple weeks. I saw Prabhupada in Los Angeles. He came there. In January early, I went back to Berkeley, where I went to school, with the intention of joining. Just taking care of some business, getting everything together, and, you know, just eliminating my last fears of moving into the ashram. Shaving my, you know, it's a big thing for a Westerner, right? You know, move in, shave your head, and like that. And then I moved in probably middle of January, something like that, right? Sometime in March, they called me in and said, you're going to go to Los Angeles to get initiated. I didn't ask to be initiated. It was just part of the program. You know, today we're going on Sankirtan. Tomorrow we're going to San Francisco to do a festival. Next week you're going to Los Angeles to get initiated. It was really just like that, just another program. We didn't really understand it. And we made these vows. We really didn't understand it. And then, so that was March. And then in August, they called me in the room and said, you're going to Los Angeles to get your second initiation. It was just, that's how it worked. So for me, having grown up that way, and in that time, everybody got first and second initiation. I mean, it was always, within 6 months to a year, it was just like, you'd get second initiation. So I grew up in that environment where practically nobody just had first initiation, not second initiation. But subsequently, because so many people had trouble, then Prabhupada said, okay, if you're serious, we'll give you second initiation, but if you're not, we won't. So, I would naturally say everyone should strive to get second initiation, but there's no point in getting it if you're not qualified. But you should try for it. You should, you know, elevate yourself. And then you can chant these Diksha mantras. You can worship Krishna with these mantras. They're very intimate mantras that can reveal so many things. They're actually mantras that worship Radharani, the gopis, Govinda, and worship your guru and Mahaprabhu. So you can chant these. Why not? If you can, why not do it? So, but if you're not on that level, then yeah. You can still love God, Timothy. But second initiation makes it more intimate and personal. Because Krishna's a person. And you get more intimately. Okay, so Krishna Kirtan Dasi is saying, why they were asked to take reinitiation in ISKCON? Because, as I was saying initially, okay, this is what happened. I'll give you a little historical background about what the Hare Krishna movement was like in the beginning. When I joined, I calculated, I looked at a BTG, and I wanted to see how many temples were in ISKCON when I became a devotee. There were 17 temples when I became a devotee. The temple that I was in had about 15 devotees. The Los Angeles temple was like one of the big temples. It had 35 devotees. San Francisco was a big temple. It had about 25. Seattle had 8. Vancouver had 4. A couple temples had 4. So I tried to average it out, you know, so give a generous estimation of 15 on the average times 17 temples. So a little over 300 people in the whole movement when I joined. 300, 400, maybe 500, you know, like living in the temples. And there were no congregation. There wasn't a, he says, either you live in the temple, a few rare grihasthas around the temple, that's it. There was no big congregation. So that's what it was like when I joined. And then I looked in BTG the next year, and it was like 42 temples. And you go the next year, like 64. And the next year, you know, like 82. And now temples were no longer 8 and 12, they were like 40, 50, 60. When Prabhupada left, when I was in Los Angeles in 1975, 76, there were about 350 devotees in Los Angeles. They're about 60 now, there's 350. Montreal, I think, had 150. New Vrindavan Mehta had 600 or something. New York probably had 300, 400. Like large numbers. Living in the temple, you know, or around the temple, communities. So, to just give you a vision of, so many people were joining, right? Just year after year. So we were inside this movement that was exponentially growing, and temples were opening all over the world. Like that, you know, it's not just America, but then we started going all over. So it was like every continent. We're in Africa, we're in Europe, we're in India. Hey, we're in South Africa, we're in Mauritius, we're in Malaysia, we're in Singapore, you know, all over, Nairobi, West Africa, right? So Prabhupada leaves and the momentum continues, right? Everyone's fired up, Prabhupada is gone, we have to carry the torch. So then, shortly after that, like 81, 82, problems started coming where leaders, gurus, were found to be breaking principles, not chanting their rounds, and so forth, and doing things, that's doing the wrong thing. And so nobody knew how to deal with this. It was just, nobody understood this. It was a crisis. And so the devotees started going to Shastra. Going to Shastra. Timothy, go to Laguna Beach and ask Tukaram what second initiation is. Because it is, I explained it in a bit of an esoteric way for people who kind of already know what it is. Just to stimulate. Second initiation is when you get Gayatri mantras and you can worship the deities. And you have a Brahman thread. Mm-hmm. You know I have a Brahman thread? Did you know? Because you can't worship the deity without wearing something on top. You have to wear a chadar and you can't wear a shirt. So in the event that you don't have a chadar, you have a thread and the thread covers the top of your body, so you're wearing something on top. Of course, the women don't have threads because they wouldn't. The men have bare chested and they wear chadars to deity worship. Second initiation is the complete. It completes the total initiation. There's five aspects we described. Anyway, so the movement's expanding, and then we had all this trouble, and nobody really knew how to deal with it. So you'd have a guru when you found out that he had a relationship with a woman, or he was taking drugs, or wasn't chanting his rounds, and you know. And eventually, over time, it was like he couldn't go on. It was just like he couldn't fake it anymore. You know, it didn't work for his disciples, didn't work for him, didn't work for the GBC. Okay, one. But then two. But then three. But then four. But then five. You know, this was happening like every few years. The next one. I think of the 11, eight of them. I think it was eight. Seven or eight.
So all non-Indians.
What?
Non-Indians, all of them.
Yeah, all non-Indians, right? So now all the devotees are in shambles, right? Because as I said, when Prabhupada left, the person who became Diksha Guru became everything for everybody. And the God brothers were kind of marginalized. Like, okay, you're just a God brother, but he's the Diksha Guru. Because when Prabhupada was here, he was everything for everybody. So we just replaced Prabhupada with that person, put him on a seat about this bit lower than Prabhupada, did Guru Puja for him every day like Prabhupada, did everything just like we did for Prabhupada. So he was like the surrogate Prabhupada. And he was like the person who was, you know, we're all missing Prabhupada, so we can. And even his god brothers were coming to his Guru Puja.
Only one devotee?
All of them.
Initiated.
Yeah, only the initiating gurus. Yeah. So he was like king in his zone, right? So when he crashed, there was this concept, guru, right? So your guru left, he's fallen. And so Shastra says, we thought Shastra said, take reinitiation, but it didn't say that. It said, take shelter of a six-year guru, but it was interpreted as reinitiation because reinitiation was told, if the guru wasn't a Vaishnava, then take reinitiation. Yeah. But when to reject or distance himself. If he's helplessly fallen, distance yourself and take shelter of a six-year guru. But you don't need reinitiation unless your initiation wasn't valid in the first place. So that wasn't clearly understood. So the GBC was recommending if your guru fell, you need to take reinitiation. So then they did some research later, maybe in the late 80s or early 90s, they did some research and they said, take shelter of someone. And it kind of left it up to that relationship whether you want to take a reinitiation. But shastrically, you don't have to. It's not necessary. I mean, you may want to. But some devotees say that it reinforces the misunderstanding that a connection with a guru is only made through initiation. It's made through siksha, just as deeply or more deeply. But every time you take reinitiation, it's like, well, I'm connected with you now, but we have to have initiation to make it. No, you don't have to have it. But some devotees just want it because, so it's more of a psychological thing than you have to do it. That's my understanding of Krishna Kirtan Dasi.
ISKCON is also siksha.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Prabhupada said that Guru is eternal.
Oh, yeah.
Siksha, Diksha, Guru. So how eternal Guru is?
Very good question.
Guru Tattva.
I have a very good answer to that. You want to hear it? She's asking. What? I just came from Mayapur. It's so hot that I have to raise the temperature here. She's asking this perennial question. The guru, you are my guru birth after birth. And Prabhupada said, don't make me come back and save you. So one of Prabhupada's god brothers, he said, well, if that's the case, then the guru will never go back to Godhead. Because he'll have to come, you know, he'll always be trying to get all his disciples. But I was thinking one day that if we don't become Krishna conscious, we'll come back to ISKCON. So Prabhupada will be our guru, birth after birth. So in that sense, Prabhupada will be our guru, birth after birth. And then in the sense of the guru is one, because the guru means the Sampradaya, the disciplic succession, the conclusion, So that position, guru, who's representing Krishna through Gaudiya Vaishnavas, that'll be one. So your whatever your guru is, that's it's the same, you know. Like one devotee, I don't know what happened. She somehow or other, through some revelation, through a dream or something, realized her identity in her last life as a brahmachari in the Gaudiya Math.
Yeah.
And I think, and I think what?
Raghava Brahmachari, 2.7, the past life.
This is a girl in England. I don't know. Maybe there's more than one. And someone else. You know, sometimes this happens. You know, so like, just practically speaking, if you lived as a Gaudiya Vaishnava in your last life, how could you have the same guru in this life? Because you would have been most likely Bhakti Siddhanta's disciple or disciple of his disciple, and now you've taken birth again. So you're in the same sampradaya. So you have the same guru. But Prabhupada, he's a founder acharya, so he'll be your guru birth after birth. And now, then it gets a little more esoteric. Will he be there in the spiritual world? Am I in that group? And all this stuff. So, you know, it's an interesting thing that Prabhupada didn't talk about that. You didn't want to talk about that. That kind of stuff. So, and the reason he didn't talk about it is because he wanted to focus on what's important is the instruction of the guru. That's what, you know, what does it matter where I came from? You know, what matters is what I'm telling you is how to get out of here. You know, and whether, you know, so you're going to get the same instruction where we were in our past life, who our guru was, if we even had one. But now we're connected with the founder acharya, so we'll always have that connection. Well, hopefully, you know. So that sense, and you know, Lokanatha Narottam, he's writing that song, "You're My Guru, Birth After Birth." So that's an eternal relationship, right? Their relationship is eternal. And they've descended from that eternal relationship to this world. So he can say, "You're my Lord, birth after birth," because that's they're eternally serving together, right? So, yeah. So, Pallavi had something. Pallavi said, "Is it normal to feel a bit scared before initiation, or is it just the feeling of something very big and important happening in one's life? Could this fear just be a fear of not disappointing one's guru, being able to be a worthy disciple? As once one is initiated, we become our guru's representative to the world." Okay. Were you nervous before your initiation? Were you scared before your initiation? He says he was sort of scared. So we're asking, is it normal? So one out of three here, were you?
I was
she was nervous? He wasn't. He was confident. You're not initiated?
No, I was in the ashram.
He was in the ashram.
Yeah.
So he didn't have to worry because the brahmacharis would hold him up. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's nice you should be concerned. But you should be happy. Prabhupada, you know, think about initiation. You know, like, as a disciple, especially a disciple of Prabhupada, Prabhupada was so awesome. That just being in his presence, oftentimes you'd just be scared. Not scared, but, you know, how should I say? I was afraid to say anything, personally, because I didn't want to, I thought I'd say something stupid. You were awed by his presence. But in many of the initiations that Prabhupada did, maybe all of them, he was joking. He was very happy. He wasn't at all like, okay, this is really serious. Everybody get serious. You know? Like one of my godbrothers, when he was initiated, Prabhupada said, "So what are the four principles?" And then the devotee said, "The four principles, no meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication." And Prabhupada said, "Which one is your favorite?" So that was Prabhupada's mood. When I was initiated, devotee next to me used to take LSD. So then when he recited the principles, Prabhupada said, "So what about LSD?" He was joking, laughing. The person closer to me, next to me, but closer, used to smoke. And Prabhupada said, "So what about smoking?" And Prabhupada went like this. So that was his mood. He was very, you know, we were all like crazy, nervous, he couldn't remember our names, so many things. You know, it was just like, you know, he just got initiated by this pure devotee who descended from the spiritual world. It was like incredible. But Prabhupada was like, you know, I think he was just very happy that the devotees were getting initiated and practicing spiritual life. And so he was a lot of times very, very light and jovial. Or encouraging, if not joking, encouraging. Like he might say something about your name. You know, like one devotee was initiated as Sarvabhauma, and so he said, Mahaprabhu defeated Sarvabhauma. Bhattacharya says, you know, he's a Mayavadi. So you go out and defeat the Mayavadis. You know, just say something like that. It's kind of light, fun. You know? So naturally disciples should be serious, but Prabhupada's mood was, it should be, you know, it's like it's your second birth, so should be kind of excited about it. I mean, it's an exciting day. You're getting, you know, your second birth, getting initiated to the Sampradaya. So, you know. The real thing is, when you take initiation, it means you have to be concerned every day of your life now. It's not just you're concerned, okay, I'm making a vow today. Because what a vow is like an agreement to pay. Vow is like an... Is there another door we can close? Is there two doors? There's no door. But if we close the door to the room... We can't close the door to the room?
Well, they have a sticker right over there.
Can we? Why?
Because they have a screen over there. When other devotees who can't sit inside, they sit here.
Oh, they're out here. Oh, okay. That's why it's so loud here. So, what was I saying?
Initiation.
So, you know, you make a vow at the time of initiation, right? So, it's like taking a loan. It's like, now I agree to pay you back. So when you take a vow at initiation, that means you're vowing to do it for the rest of your life. So in that sense, you have to remake that vow every day of your life. Because you have to follow it every day. So taking it seriously would be, right? Doing it every day, yeah.
Eternal
swarup.
So is it
that
same with Guru, which we take
Diksha? I'm not even going to repeat that question. No, not necessary. She's asking if your Guru, will you naturally find a Guru who's in the same rasa as you're in? Not necessarily, because Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that he might not be, and you might have to get a siksha guru who can. To the Jiva Dharma. Did you read that? The Jiva Dharma? It's in the Jiva Dharma. But that was not really Prabhupada's mood, because more the mood was holy name will reveal. Yeah. If you ask some guru in ISKCON, you say, can you tell me who I am, what my swarup is? You know, say, get out of here. Yeah. So there was a tradition in the time of Bhaktivinoda and previously that the guru would say, I think your sarup is this, and give you a name, and it's called Ekadas Bhav, and who you are in the spiritual world, your name, your service. But then sometimes the disciple would come back and say, that's not working for me. So it wasn't like he exactly knew it. He kind of thought this was it, and said, well, let's try this one on now. But Prabhupada never did that. Bhaktisiddhanta didn't do it, although I was told he did it for sannyasis, or maybe the Babaji's, he might have given them that. But in general, that wasn't the mood. I think Prabhupada's mood was more the mood of give your life for spreading Krishna consciousness, everything will come from that. That was his basic. Because you can see his emphasis was always on compassion. You know, that's the real thing. Bhaktisiddhanta's mission. And I think he was perhaps a little concerned about getting too much into rasa tattva, that could stop the preaching. Because when the devotees were were just hearing about the gopis, then Prabhupada stopped it. He said they weren't qualified, and that's not, you don't just hear about the gopis. And then he said that that would ruin the preaching. It would stop it. So he was always pushing that, you know, actively engaged. And then, you know, as you become more qualified to hear and chant more and higher topics, that would be natural. But it's still more of a private thing. Because he set the example, even in the end of his life, he was still thinking about preaching. So you could say it was an example. You might say it was his own bhav. That was his bhajan, to preach. You know, you could say maybe it's not an example, as it was just who he was. Or you could say it was an example. He wanted us to do that. So, it's 8 o'clock, and all is well in Mumbai. All is well except my stomach. But last week I ate something. I ate some lychees, and that was the beginning of the end of my stomach. Now I have Ayurvedic medicine. It's trying to put it back together. Yeah. I mean, I always eat lychees. This was, I don't know, I ate them. Yeah.
So they were hot, so possibly you must have had
reactions. I think lychees are hot as such. I think it's too ripe, though, maybe. And I had them after a meal. I didn't eat them by themselves. Anyway, when we first used to come to India, we'd get so sick. And as soon as we got on the airplane, we'd get better because they had good water and the food was different. We were like in the villages, you know, drinking village water and village food and cooking with motor oil or whatever they used, you know, some kind of weird oil. And then we'd get back on the plane and we'd just eat normal food in the West and we'd get better. We'd drink water. So anyway. Any other questions? You can develop love of God, Timothy, if you chant Shuddha Nam. And if you get second initiation, it'll help you. It makes it easier. But if you're not qualified, don't push it. And if you are, then good.
Prabhupada also stated that if you chant 16 rounds and follow your Ayurvedic principles and serve in the Guru's mission, then one can go back to God in this lifetime.
Yeah.
So, like, can you comment something on that?
The Prabhupada said 16 rounds, 4 regular principles, serve the mission of the Guru and go back to God in this lifetime by His mercy. The way we understand that is, if Prabhupada said it, Krishna will uphold it. Right? And you might say, well, let me look at that from a Shastric perspective and say, 16 rounds, serve my Guru, and 4 regular principles. Now, according to Shastra, you have to be free from all material desires. You have to cultivate Raga Nuga Bhakti, and then you have to come, you have to go through all these processes, and then come to, you know, then you want to cultivate it in the mood of the residents of Vrindavan, and this, that, and the next thing, and there's a process, right? And you say, well, I haven't even developed, I'm not even on Nishta yet. What if I die tomorrow? I'm still in Nartha Nivritti. What if I die tomorrow? Or I'm only on the stage of Ruchi. I don't have Bhava. And Bhava's not even enough. Then what? So Prabhupada said, no, this lifetime you can see Krishna. So he's making the guarantee. So he'll, by his mercy, he'll make it happen, and Krishna will have to uphold it. That's the idea.
So, like, does it mean that 16 rounds we have to try our best, not even like Shuddha, even if we don't reach Shuddha?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were talking this morning, there's a broader sense of Shuddha. Shuddha, as you say in Sanskrit, and yeah. Shuddha, as you say in Hindi. Hindi, you say Shuddha?
No, Shuddha, but Gujarati, he's Gujarati, and Gujarati doesn't know difference between Shuddha and Shuddha.
You say, so in Hindi it's Shuddha or
Shuddha?
Shuddha. Yeah, so same in Sanskrit, Shuddha. Shuddha Nama. Shuddha Nama. So we were discussing this morning that if you chant the holy name without any motive for material gain, without any motive to become liberated from suffering, even to become liberated from this world just to please Krishna, that in a broad sense is Shuddha Nama. So, you know, broad sense of pure devotional service, broad sense of Shudanam. That's Prabhupada's definition. And so that will bring you to the stage of love of God, and you keep chanting. So you go to the Shastra. There's, you know, there's so many verses in the Bhagavatam about the glories of the holy name. So many, you know. So there's nothing higher, nothing more productive. It will give everything. Nam will do everything, Nam will give everything. It's tapasya, it's austerity, it's knowledge, it's wealth, it's purity, it's Nam's everything. So we have that faith. It's Kali Yuga. We're not capable of much in Kali Yuga. So Nam, we say Nam is everything. We're not like highly qualified. But Nam will do everything. So Prabhupada said 16 rounds, if you chant purely, he's also saying the 16 rounds is so powerful by the power of that, and you serve the mission of the pure devotee, and you get so much kripa from serving him. Then Krishna could take you back to Godhead. Yes.
So Guruji, like when we mention back to Godhead, so is it we go to Bhoma Vrindavan or do we directly go to spiritual world? Because we have to get trained, right?
After. Yeah, yeah.
Because we are not
so he's asking, do we go directly to the spiritual world, or do we go to Bhoma Vrindavan, or do we go to Navadvip? That's another question. Where do you go? What form do you take? And so generally, the understanding is, first, if you're not completely purified, you have to take part in Krishna's pastimes. You know, when Krishna played his flute, some gopis, they didn't make it. Their husbands wouldn't let them go. And the reason, the explanation is, what's the explanation? Because they weren't still ready for the Rasa Leela. They weren't ready to dance and Rasa dance. And so they got purified by that. And then when Krishna played his flute, the next time, then they went. So that's how it works. So if you're already on that level, then you can go straight. But the Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, if you want, you can take a form in Gauranga Leela also. And you can take a form in both. Krishna Leela, Gauranga Leela, or Krishna Leela, or Gauranga Leela, or both.
But like, I mean, I thought generally, like, because we are in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's vision, so like, naturally we will get both forms.
If you want. Antonio, yeah. The Jivadharma says, whatever you want is what you'll get. Oh, you could say, yeah, that's true. Who wants to go to Gaur Leela? Who wants to go to Braja Leela? So, yeah. Who wants to stay in Mumbai Leela? You know, we're in a hospital here, so, you know, you get some hospital realization. So I left Mayapur. I'd been in Mayapur, I came to India in the beginning of November, did a little traveling. I think I was gone for about 6 weeks out of Mayapur. So I've been actually in Mayapur of the last 8 months, like six and a half or something. So I was feeling really bad leaving Mayapur. And when I left Mayapur, I was kind of feeling like there's really nothing in this world. There's really nothing here, nothing really going on. And I was thinking about something interesting, and it just dawned on me. How there's I've read so many so-called spiritualists and motivational speakers, and they talk about having a good attitude. You know, things are bad, but see the positive side. You have a positive attitude, be upbeat. You know, if it's bad now, it's going to get better. It's just God's test. You know, all this, right? Right, all this positive thinking, and these people are very positive. They're very happy. You know, so I was thinking, in the spiritual world, are there motivational speakers telling you to be positive? Why do you have people telling you to be positive here? Because things are so bad that that's how you try to counteract the misery. No, it's bad. You'll just become so depressed. So, no, be positive. See the good side, you know. You can just be happy, you know. Just appreciate whatever you have, you know. But the reality is, it's so bad here that if you don't do that, you'll go crazy. If you don't just say, everything's good, I love life, look at the beautiful sun, the air, God's... You know, you have to just be able to appreciate things. Otherwise, you'll look around and go, this place is horrible. It, you know, what does everybody do? They're all struggling just to get some food, not get kicked out of their house and their car, you know, repossessed, you know, isn't it? And their homes repossessed. Isn't it? That's what's going on out there when you actually look at it all. Right? And now I'm in the hospital. What's going on in the hospital? Even my body's falling. I mean, I'm in the hospital, so I'm like, I'm checking out all the things wrong with my body. You know, it's like, might as well check it out, you know. I've got pain in my arm. I go, what's that? And you go, it's old age, Prabhu, you know. I think it's arthritis in the arm, you know. My foot, what's wrong with your foot? Well, your bone's kind of falling down, you know. What about the circulation? Yeah, well, you have a little arterial sclerosis. It's just starting, but it's not bad. You know, it's like, you know, so what's going on in the hospital? We're fighting, the body's getting old, it naturally falls apart, and we're fighting it, putting it together, patching it up, you know. This is the world we live in, where you have to psych yourself up every day. Look in the mirror. I love myself. I'm good. I'm confident. I'm great. I'm happy. Go out and face all the people who are going to attack me and telling me I'm a jerk. I'm an idiot. Try to put me down, telling you, I hate you. You're stupid. How could you do that? You know, and you have to go home. I'm great. I'm fine. I'm good. I can do it. I'm smart. You know, that's the world we live in. You know, so then the body's falling apart. And, you know, go to the doctor, patch this, patch that, patch this, patch that. You know, then it gets really bad in America because, you know, 65-year-old women in America do not look like 65-year-old women in India, right? They don't have one gray hair on their head. It's dyed. They've had plastic surgery a few times. They dress like, you know, 22-year-old. You know, it's like they really try to defy aging, you know. 48 and 52, Indian woman is what the women in their mid-60s look like in America, right? You know, you come in and say, how old are you? And they say, 63. They go, I thought you were 45. You know, that's, they just do everything to defy old age. That's, you know. Skin creams, makeups, this, that, you know, eat healthy, you know, like that. Nothing wrong with it, but that's what we're fighting against. We're getting old, you know. Don't look so beautiful when you're 65. You look beautiful when you're 28, but 65, you know, unless you had a lot of plastic surgery, like a few of them, it's tough, you know. So it was just hitting me. I was just looking at this world, and it was hitting me, thinking, it's actually, everything is negative, and our whole time we're here, we're just trying to deal with it and get all the negative out of the way. And you go, how's it going, Prabhu? And you go, it's going good. Why? Because I got this negative out, that negative out, and now it's going good. For how long? Right? It's just interesting, you know. Be positive. Yeah, be upbeat, you know. Look at the good side. Be optimistic. Everything's like that. So that was my hospital realization. So, okay, Antonio asking a question. We're going to ask this to the assembled Vaishnavas. This is a tough question. What if you want to take shelter of a Siksha guru, but your Diksha guru does not give his blessing? What do you do? Prabhupada said, if there's a conflict between Siksha and Diksha, you always follow the Diksha Guru. But what if you've lost faith in the Diksha Guru?
If you, once Gaurabha Guru said that, even if you somehow don't believe in the Diksha Guru,
the thing that we're discussing also is if the Diksha Guru has deviated in some non-Vaishnava way, then Shastra says, okay, you can distance yourself or like this. So there are some times when you can just say, okay, this person is not bona fide, or but that you'd have to check. And it's kind of difficult for your Siksha Guru to say, your Diksha Guru is not bona fide. Yes, what's your understanding?
It's like, according to this Narottam Das Thakur, and we read many times in Prabhupada book, Guru Sadhu Shastra. So sometimes it is very easily identical that Guru is not following the basic rules, as you mentioned in lecture. But sometimes, if you see the Chaitanya Lila, it is mentioned that, you know, even Nityananda goes to the, you know, the drinking alcohol bar. Then you should give him a like benefit of doubt. But then again, in some strict sannyasis, they say, you know, that you should be very careful. Like Prabhupada, you know, like when some small girls, they came to here in Mumbai on the top floor, they wanted to show the dance, this very small girl. So they were forcing Prabhupada that we want to show. They were in sari, very nicely dressed. Prabhupada didn't look towards them. Uh-huh. He was just looking towards other side. They were dancing.
Uh-huh.
So Prabhupada himself, he was preaching that very clearly, that sannyasis should not see. But when we see many sannyasis, they are seeing, then we should understand how much we want very strictness, the dilutes and like that.
So what's the conclusion?
Conclusion is that, according to me, that if it is very much the main, bigger things, like not chanting, roaming with the women, or like that.
Yeah, so it's going to be some of the bigger things.
Yeah, and sometimes like very small, you know, like if he is very Westerner, so he would drink, you know, all the time, like juices, ice creams.
What if your guru goes surfing? That's okay. Timothy, I haven't gone surfing. The last time I went surfing was actually 10 years ago. So for 10 years I haven't gone surfing. And the time before I went that was also 10 years. So I actually surfed as a devotee, believe it or not. But, and there is a guru who's a surfer in South India. So, doesn't a lot of it depend on the faith of the disciple? Let's say you lose faith. Maybe it's not even justified that you lost faith, but you've lost faith. So if you lost faith, you need, I would say, this is my general answer, you need to take shelter of someone you have faith in, because you don't want to, you can't exist without faith in Krishna consciousness. So even if they said no, but you no longer had faith in them, you need to have faith in someone to hear. So, and Krishna will inspire you in the heart what to do and how to behave. And then you can go surfing. No, talking about surfing here. Pray to Krishna sincerely, yeah. We have some comments, yes. On this question?
No, the same.
Yeah, the same thing, yeah.
So probably it might also depend on the level of advancement of the guru. If the Diksha guru is actually a Nitya Siddha devotee, or probably he is a Uttama Adhikari, then maybe he is able to actually, you know, because whatever the Nitya Siddha devotee says, it's always true. So in that case, he is not having the blessings in the Siksha, the Diksha disciple, he is not having the blessing of that guru. Then the guru can actually clearly see that he is not going to take that instruction from that other Siksha guru. So in that case, it might be possible that actually, irrespective of the faith level, it's not actually recommended for that disciple to take siksha. But if the guru is probably on a Madhyama Adhikari level and he's not able to see the whole entire picture, and if he's saying out of experience...
I don't know. Can you all hear this? Let me know if you're hearing what he's saying, because otherwise I'll repeat it.
So yeah, like, I mean... if
yes, no? You can hear this? No, they can't. Oh, okay. He's going to come over here. He's saying, I'll repeat it, he's saying, well, if the guru is an Uttama Adhikari, Nitya Siddha, don't mess with them, because they know what they're talking about, basically he's saying. But... that's basically what he said in so many words, that, you know, he may understand that it's a problem you have, and going to a Siksha guru, you're basically avoiding the problem and like that. But if the guru is a Madhyama Adhikari, then
like, I mean,
and you've lost faith in your guru, they're a Madhyama Adhikari, your faith is weak now, then, but they tell you not to go to the Siksha guru, then what do you say?
Well, actually, you know, if Madhyama Adhikari, it also has some certain levels of advancement, because there is like Madhyama Madhyam, then there is Uttama Madhyam, and there is Kanishtha. So, like, I mean, there is a lot of difference between the instructions of a...
So it depends on what level the Madhyam is. Anyway, I think they're saying on the chat that the devotee should be sincere. I saw one time a Diksha guru kind of rejected one of his disciples because of the way the disciple was behaving. And another Diksha guru accepted her. It was like a Siksha disciple. And she was fine, because she had the shelter of somebody else. So even that guru, you know, so as long as you're under, you know, like that story of Mukunda. Mukunda, he was sometimes an impersonalist and sometimes a devotee. So Mahaprabhu and his Leela rejected him, but the devotees pleaded to Mahaprabhu and the devotees gave him shelter. So even Mahaprabhu rejected him, he got shelter of the devotees, and because of the kripa of those devotees, he was okay. So you always want to get somebody's kripa. So this situation here is a difficult situation because this devotee has lost faith in his guru because of something the guru did. So now he's asking, now he's saying, she doesn't want me to take, his guru doesn't want him to take shelter anywhere else. And so now he's in this conundrum. So faith is an important thing.
Yeah, Guruji, actually I just remember when I was listening to Mani Maharaj's Guru Tattva lecture.
Yeah.
He said the same, in the same context basically.
Mahaniri Swami said in the same context that...
He said that if the disciple is not having complete faith...
If the disciple is not having complete faith in someone, in a Diksha Guru...
And then if he wants to go and take shelter of some other devotee...
He wants to take shelter of another devotee.
Or maybe he wants to satisfy his own desire and not listen to his guru's instruction. Then what happens...
Or satisfy his own... Well, that's two different things, right? Satisfy his own desire is one thing.
Yeah, but we don't know, like... I mean, in this case, like, we don't know how much faith he has.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's kind of like his own gratification also, probably. So, what Maharaj said is basically... the guru always prays for the disciple's welfare. So, if the Diksha disciple, if he leaves the guru and goes to another Siksha...
If the Diksha disciple leaves and goes to another Siksha guru...
Still, although the Diksha guru does not permit him...
Although the Diksha guru doesn't permit...
But once he goes to that Siksha...
Once he goes to the Siksha guru...
The Diksha guru actually prays for the disciple.
The Diksha Guru prays for the disciple.
For his welfare.
For his welfare.
And so, after that, probably things might still be favorable for him. Even though he might have, for some time, he might have temporarily...
Things will be favorable between him and the Diksha Guru, or favorable in his spirit?
No, for his spiritual life.
So things might be favorable for his spiritual... So
because the Diksha Guru is praying for his welfare.
Because the Diksha Guru is praying for his welfare. So you could at least ask your Diksha Guru to... If you feel the necessity to take shelter of Siksha Guru, ask your Diksha Guru to pray for your welfare.
Actually, he prays naturally. It's not like we don't even have to ask.
Hopefully you don't have to ask. Krishna Kirtan Dasi is saying... Senaya says... I have a question. What if I don't want to enter the particular pastimes of my guru and I feel like this sangha is foreign and I belong somewhere else? Will Diksha Guru still help me find my own place in some different part of the spiritual world? Don't worry about it. Just worry about getting out of here. Krishna will take care of everything. No doubt about it. Krishna will take care of everything. Just become Krishna conscious. This is such an interesting topic, isn't it? And we should end soon because we have all these people here waiting to do something like eat or see me and finish our business up. Then you dare give your arguments and insist. This is what Krishna Kirtan is saying. Usually they think over and surrender reluctantly with some conditions. Many thanks to Mahatma Prabhu for daring openly such a controversial issue. Yes. All this stuff needs to be spoken about it. Maybe I'll get... it's important. I hate to hide things and sweep them under the carpet. If anyone would like to receive notifications, yeah, okay. So, yeah, we have to talk about these things. They're important because it's real life, you know. You'll get initiated by someone and, you know, 10, 20 years later, you might find another devotee who's giving you what you need more. In our ISKCON society, it should not be a problem. If the guru is outside of ISKCON, it becomes more of an issue because then maybe the guru has an issue with ISKCON and they don't want you to take guidance from somebody in ISKCON, so it complicates it.